From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As cases of COVID-19 climb across the country, up nearly 200% in the last 2 weeks, hospitals in some places are filling as well. Dr. Thomas Dobbs, Mississippi's state health officer, tweeted this week, "The fourth wave is here." At Houston Methodist Hospital in Texas, 184 COVID patients have been admitted. That's double the number from July 1st. Most of them are unvaccinated and infected with the Delta variant. But hospital physician and CEO Mark Boom says at least one hospitalization is a patient infected with the Lambda variant. That's a strain of this coronavirus that started in Peru and is now rampant in parts of South America. Dr. Boom joins us from Houston, and first, welcome back to Here and Now. But start with the Lambda variant. What do we know about it?
Well, the Lambda variant has taken over the country of Peru. What we don't understand yet is how it will compete with the Delta variant, which is the predominant variant now in the United States. At Houston Methodist, we sequence every patient who comes through, the genomes of each virus that we isolate. And we've seen now all the way up to 85% of our isolates are Delta, but now we've started seeing Lambda creep into the data as well. So we're watching that with interest and with concern. But the fundamental issue is that Delta is significantly out of control, and we're seeing a major surge in Houston and beyond.
Well, we want to talk about that, but just, you know, there are different variants around the world. In France, for instance, there's something called Beta. We're going to take that up at another time. But so now you have at least one Lambda. And we understand that a Chilean study of healthcare workers published last month found increased infectivity, according to the writing about that. So the concern is that these variants are more infectious, and the WHO classified it as a variant of interest. Just remind us what that means.
Basically means a variant that we're concerned enough about that may actually outcompete some of the others. I think the bottom line, whether you look at a Lambda that's happening in Peru and in South America, or you look at a Delta, which is happening in much of the rest of the world, it's clear that these are significantly more effective at spreading than previous ones that we saw. And we've seen an iteration of that time and time again throughout the pandemic. And this is what's catching up with us, frankly, because of lack of vaccination at this point and because of so many people still infected.
Right. It's allowing this virus to mutate. We'll talk about that. We understand most of the people you're admitting are unvaccinated. That's true in most hospitals across the country. What are they saying? People who either chose to not get vaccinated or just maybe couldn't for whatever the reason, access?
The most common thing we'll hear is just significant regret that people missed their opportunity. They recognize and acknowledge that they had a moment in which they could have protected themselves, they could have protected loved ones, and now they're dealing with a disease, you know, many times they never thought they would get. We still remarkably see some people who, you know, regardless of that, still wouldn't have wanted to get vaccinated or still are skeptical about the illness, but most people express significant regret.
Texas, you know, has been struggling to get people vaccinated, ranking 38th out of 50 states with under 43% of the total population vaccinated. It also has two of the most infected counties in the country. That's Dimmitt and Karnes. Now, I said Mississippi's health officer says a fourth surge is there. Do you think it's in Texas as well?
Oh, no question. The kinds of increases we're seeing right now in Houston, which is actually on the much higher end of vaccination within the state, it's the fastest we've seen since last summer. It's actually going up more quickly than we saw for the winter surge. And it really turned on a dime. And so we're very, very concerned about what we've seen. You know, numbers now doubling in about a week. And every indicator, whether it's the percentage of people we're testing positive, the number of people that are positive, and now the number of people in the hospital, you know, we've really squandered our opportunity to push this down. And then we've let Delta come up and be an issue in the United States. And because of the unvaccinated population we still have, it is finding a foothold and finding a foothold very, very quickly.
Well, doctor, we know your staff is fully vaccinated. A judge dismissed a lawsuit from some of them that tried to block your vaccine mandate. So they are vaccinated. But look, more infectious variants, Delta, Lambda, maybe waiting in the wings. Are you even worried about your vaccinated staff? And how are they doing, knowing that they're facing yet another surge because they're vaccinated, but people coming in aren't?
You know, what I hear is resolve because they are tough-minded individuals who know the right thing to do and are called to care for people. But I also hear frustration because there's this, you know, deep feeling that this is so avoidable, what we're dealing with now. And so it's very hard to see people, you know, day in, day out, the vast majority of whom are unvaccinated, now unfortunately struggling for breath, now unfortunately very ill. And we know across the United States about 9% death rate once people are admitted into the hospitals. And so, you know, every day we're looking at people that we know may pass away in the future within our walls. And that is something, of course, we always resolve to avoid. And so it's a tough time for those hospital employees. We're going to be doing everything we can to support them. But they're an amazing group of people who've done an incredible job now for, you know, virtually 18 months.
Yeah. Hear, hear. That's Dr. Mark Boom, CEO at Houston Methodist Hospital. He also practices internal medicine. Dr. Boom, thank you and best to you and your staff there.
Thank you so much. Thanks for telling this story. We got to get more people vaccinated. So thanks so much.
Tokyo hit a six-month high in new COVID-19 infections today as the competition in the Summer Olympics gets underway. Japan opened the games with an 8-1 win over Australia in women's softball, but the U.S. women's soccer team got off to a rocky start. Sweden stunned the Americans 3-0. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman joins us now. Tom, the U.S. women were riding a 44-match winning streak when they came into this game. What happened?
That winning streak doesn't matter right now, Celeste. They got thumped soundly. Sweden dominated from the start, had the U.S. on its heels for most of the game. The Americans' defense didn't hold up. On offense, the U.S. couldn't get any serious attacks going. The U.S. women's national team did not look like a team riding that big win streak or the team that's won the last two World Cups.
But this doesn't mean that the Americans are out of the Olympics now, right? I mean, what happens now?
Yeah, that's right. This happened in the round-robin group stage where teams play and jockey for position in their groups to qualify for the knockout stage where you lose and you're out. So the U.S. next plays New Zealand. A win would be advisable. You have a feeling the U.S. will come out roaring in that game.
So we are also seeing players taking a knee before some of these matches as a symbolic gesture against racism. Have we heard anything from the International Olympic Committee in response to these actions?
It was actually action by the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, which prompted this. The IOC relaxed its Rule 50, as it's called, which traditionally bans political expression at the games, allowing, among other things, the pregame protests like what you're seeing with teams taking a knee. The IOC has been criticized, though, for still not allowing gestures during competition or during medal ceremonies, where, of course, an act of protest would have much more impact.
So let's go back to the actual games themselves, because there is some good news, right? At least the U.S. women's softball team got off to a fairly good start. What happened in that game against Italy?
Yeah, the U.S. is top-ranked in the world, and it beat Italy 2-0. And it was a triumphant return for pitcher Kat Osterman. She was a great pitcher for the U.S. back in 2008, the last time softball was in the Olympics. But she was the losing pitcher in the 2008 gold medal game, which was won by Japan. Now, softball was dropped from the Olympic program after that and is only back now. Osterman has been retired, but when softball came back, she decided to come back herself. She came out of retirement. She's now 38, and she looked pretty good in the Italy game. She held the Italians to one hit, struck out 9. She and the U.S. are on a redemption tour, using the 2008 Olympics as their motivation, and they're off to a good start.
Does she have a chance to get her gold this time?
Oh, she does. I mean, Japan and the U.S. are considered the gold medal favorites. The U.S., as I mentioned, is the top-ranked team. in the world. So it should be a good competition, and we hope it's a good competition, and it convinces the IOC to keep softball as a permanent event in the Olympics, because it's fun. I've covered a number of softball competitions starting back in 1996. These athletes are fantastic. They always inspire a lot of young girls who play softball. And the softball competition is not in the next Summer Games in Paris, but they're hoping to come back for the ones after that in 2028 in Los Angeles.
We did get some news today, Tom, about future Olympic Games. Can you tell us what we heard?
Yes, we heard that Brisbane won the bidding. Brisbane, Australia won the bidding for the 2032 Summer Olympics. It's the third time Australia will host the Games after Melbourne in 1956 and Sydney in 2000.
Although summer is winter in Australia, so maybe we have to rename
it. Now you're confusing me, Celeste. It's late in Tokyo.
NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman in Tokyo. Tom, thanks.
You're welcome.
President Biden heads to Cincinnati today. He hopes to drum up more support for the bipartisan infrastructure deal that he brokered with Congress. But as the president hits the road, Republican senators in Washington are gearing up to vote against starting debate on this first phase of infrastructure spending today. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says he wants to get the ball rolling as bipartisan talks progress, and here he is on the Senate floor yesterday.
Senators of goodwill on both sides want to finish the bipartisan infrastructure bill before the August recess. That's certainly my goal. But in order to finish the bill, we first need to agree to start.
Meanwhile, the spread of the Delta coronavirus variant is complicating things in Washington. More staffers have tested positive. Let's bring our political strategist to discuss all of this. Bill Press is here. He's a Democratic strategist. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Celeste. Good to be with you.
And you. And Alice Stewart is with us as well. She's a Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Celeste. Great to be with you here where summer is summer.
It is summer. Let's start with this vote today. Republicans plan to block it. The question is, what is the goal here, do you think? If they don't begin debate soon, they may run out of time. Is that the hope?
I think as the Republican here, I think the goal would be to move forward on a bipartisan infrastructure bill. I think people across the country realize that we do need to fund infrastructure. The problem with where things are now, even with all of this back and forth, there are concerns about the details of what is out there. And I think no one has been more genuine in the talks than Senator Mitt Romney, and he is having problems moving forward. And he has said quite clearly that he's concerned about the motion to proceed without seeing the summary of the bill and not seeing the pay-fors. And this, to me, has shades of Obamacare, where Nancy Pelosi said we need to pass the bill before we can find out what's in it. And until there are more details on the table, I think this will be very challenging to move forward.
So, Bill, go ahead.
Yes. I just going to jump in and say, look, first, my feeling about this is a pox on both of their houses. I mean, you want to talk about infrastructure? Let's talk about the Champlain Towers in Surfside, Florida. That building was only 40 years old. And a collapse. There are 4,500 bridges in this country that are in as bad, if not worse, shape than the Champlain Towers. And the idea that Congress, both parties, can't get together and solve this problem and can't agree on a bill, I think is a disgrace. It just shows that the Senate has become practically unworkable. And this is a good test of that, example of that. This vote, and whether they have it or not, you know, I kind of don't care. But it's only a vote to vote. It's not a vote on a bill. It's not to vote on something they haven't seen. It's not to vote for anything. It's a vote to say, yes, we're going to vote on this as soon as it's finished. So, again, pox on both their houses for not getting this done. I hope that they say, Republicans and Democrats say, whatever happens today, they're going to continue working on it. I think they will. I think they should. And get the damn thing done.
you know, Bill, I'm sure you can perhaps sympathize then with people who, voters, who say, look, the Democrats of both the House and the Senate and the president's office, Biden has now been in office for a full 6 months. Is his administration running out of time at this point? Are we getting a little too close to midterms?
No, I do think I hear this a lot. My God, he's been there 6 months. Why hasn't he solved every problem on the planet, right? I
mean, right.
We have to be a little realistic. No, I don't think he's run out of time at all. I think we keep coming back to this, something Alice and I disagree on. Again, it's unworkable as long as the filibuster is there. The idea that you have to have 60 votes, again, not for a bill, 60 votes to vote is just absurd. The filibuster is being used to prevent all forward progress on any major legislation. It's got to be fixed.
So, Alice,
I will just say this. With regard to the filibuster, the Democrats didn't have a problem with it when they used it in their favor. Now they don't want it, which I think is quite rich. But I think the important thing is no one expects President Biden and the administration to solve all problems, but it would be helpful if they passed one problem and resolved one problem in a bipartisan fashion, which is how he ran and what he campaigned on. And I truly believe many people would support the bipartisan infrastructure plan in the scaled back form, which was agreed upon weeks ago. It's just right now, the fact they're refusing to put details and pay fors in there, it makes it difficult. Let's check the infrastructure box, but keep it just about infrastructure and not the progressive wish list, which is being added bit by bit.
Let's move on here just for a second, Bill.
Right.
There is a lot to talk about today. Today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi rejected two Republican appointments to the select committee that would be looking into the January 6th insurrection. They were Representatives Jim Jordan of Ohio and Jim Banks of Indiana. They both voted against certifying President Biden's election victory in January. But, Bill, what do you think of Nancy Pelosi's decision here?
I think she made the right decision. And I think Kevin McCarthy has nobody to blame but himself. Because, remember, it was Kevin McCarthy, at the behest of Donald Trump, who rejected the bipartisan January 6th commission, which would have given Kevin McCarthy total authority to appoint whomever he wanted and to hire whatever staff he wanted. He rejected that, and he gets stuck now with a select committee, one of the rules of which was that the speaker has final say over who sits on it, both Democrats and Republicans. Just a quick add here, Celeste. I think the real target here was Jim Jordan. Let's face it, Jim Jordan is not a person who wants to get anything done. He's a total rabble-rouser. He's obnoxious. He just steals the camera and the microphone. And I think that Nancy Pelosi was just trying to prevent Jim Jordan from making this a circus. But she couldn't just single out Jim Jordan. She had to take one other with him, and Jim Banks happened to be the other fall guy.
Trying to get inside the mind of Nancy Pelosi. But Alice, what are we to make of the decision to choose Jim Jordan and Jim Banks on the Republicans' part? They chose two people who voted against certifying the president's election.
That didn't surprise me at all, given the fact that many Republicans don't want this investigation to go forward anyway. I don't agree with that. I think the insurrection at the Capitol was atrocious, and we need to have a full investigation. We need to have a full report so that this doesn't happen again. The problem with that for Republicans is, as Bill mentioned, they missed their opportunity for a bipartisan sort of 9/11 commission style investigation by not going forward with that in the past. So
right.
I think that the key right now is let's get as many people open-minded that we can on this commission and let the investigation proceed. But it's not surprising that Republicans would try to, in essence, stack the deck. But, you know, the truth will come to the surface, and facts are facts. No matter how hard someone wants to pound their hands on the table, the facts of what happened and the video and the audio are disturbing, and it's really hard to refute that.
Let's touch on the pandemic, because the Delta variant is responsible at this point for at least 83% of new cases in the U.S. That's according to data from the CDC. It's spreading mostly among the unvaccinated. More Republicans are beginning to speak up. Here is Fox News host Sean Hannity.
please take COVID seriously. I can't say it enough. Enough people have died. We don't need any more death. Research like crazy. Talk to your doctor, your doctors, medical professionals you trust based on your unique medical history, your current medical condition, and you and your doctor make a very important decision for your own safety. Take it seriously.
We heard a similar plea from Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. Alice, this is a tough turn for some Republicans to make, including Hannity, at this point after they fought masks and vaccine requirements.
Well, bravo for the decision to make the change now and saying that he believes in the science of vaccination because it's critically important. And the frustration, Celeste, is that this health issue has become a political issue and it shouldn't be that way. It's not a partisan issue. And I think it's really important, as Sean mentioned and others are saying, have these serious conversations with your doctors and your healthcare professionals and make the right decision for you. I'm a strong proponent of vaccines, and I think it's important. But there is also the issue, it's not just political. I talked with my friend, Mayor Frank Scott, the Black Democrat mayor of Little Rock, Arkansas, and he says there's also a rural America issue, and we need to educate people about the importance of vaccines.
Alice Stewart is a Republican strategist, and Bill Press is a Democratic strategist. Thanks to both of you, as always.
All right.
Thank you, Celeste.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
The man who ran former President Trump's inaugural fund has been charged with acting as an agent of a foreign government. Tom Barrack was arrested yesterday. Federal prosecutors say he used his access to the White House to help the United Arab Emirates. Barrack is the latest member of Trump's orbit to be indicted with federal crimes. And so let's bring in NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Celeste.
It looks like the thrust of this investigation was looking at the time period between April 2016, before Donald Trump was president, to 2018. What interested prosecutors in Tom Barrack?
Basically, he's a person who's been close to President Trump, former President Trump, for decades now. They met doing a real estate deal in New York. But Barrack has remained pretty close as a friend to Trump over the years. He spoke at the 2016 political convention for Trump and was kind of an emissary for the candidate, then President Trump. And he got on prosecutors' radar, apparently because of some communications he had with a foreign government, the United Arab Emirates, and people tied to the UAE during the campaign, and that persisted into Trump's presidency. Basically, prosecutors say Barrack exploited his close ties to the White House to try to win favors and favorable treatment for this foreign government without registering those activities with the U.S. Justice Department as is required by law.
It looks like he's charged with 7 counts. In addition to what we've already talked about, acting as an agent of a foreign government, what else is he charged with?
Yeah, he's charged with obstructing justice and lying to the FBI when the FBI came knocking on his door in 2019. The Justice Department said he lied about his ties to the UAE and some other activities. He basically, the Justice Department says, was inserting words in speeches of then-candidate Donald Trump to favor the UAE. He asked the UAE for a wish list for what it wanted during the Trump presidency. And he went on television and wrote op-eds that basically spouted talking points favorable to this foreign government, all according to the indictment.
Prosecutors say included is this comment that it looks like it's a betrayal of the former president. What do we know about whether or not there were connections or anyone in the Trump administration knew about what Barrack was doing?
There's no evidence of that in the court papers themselves, Celeste, but there is some correspondence dating back to 2016 that seems to indicate then-campaign chairman Paul Manafort was somewhat familiar with some of Barrack's activities. Of course, former President Trump is not charged with any wrongdoing in this case, nor is anyone else who was in the White House during that time. These charges focus on Barrack, one of his employees at his investment firm, and another foreign national who allegedly lied to the FBI about these activities.
And prosecutors have called Barrack a serious flight risk. Where is Barrack now?
Barrick is now locked up in Los Angeles in federal custody while he awaits a longer bail hearing. Prosecutors in Brooklyn are the ones who are going to pursue this case, and they called him a flight risk in part because he's extremely wealthy, has access to private planes, and ties, close ties, to countries with no extradition treaties to the U.S., places like the UAE and Lebanon, where he is a citizen.
And what about the other two men who were charged? Where are they?
Grimes is also locked up alongside Barrick. He and Barrick both pleaded not guilty yesterday afternoon or early evening in Los Angeles, but they're going to remain in custody until a judge determines otherwise. And the third man, Rashid Al-Malik, is in foreign hands and is not available to the Justice Department at this time.
That's NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been facing tough questions while touring damage from those devastating floods last week that killed at least 196 people. Germans are asking why their country, famous for engineering and its leading role in climate change negotiations, could be caught so tragically off guard by the kind of extreme weather that climate scientists have predicted for years. The past few weeks have also seen a blistering heat wave in the American West, an above-normal hurricane season is predicted, and the kind of extreme weather events that climate change will make more likely and more severe are said to be coming. Frederica Otto is Associate Director of the Environmental Change Institute at Oxford University in the UK. Freddie, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And start with the flooding. We know that rising temperatures caused by the greenhouse effect of gas emissions means we're living, you know, kind of inside a greenhouse, which is holding on to moisture, which then rains down on us. Now, we can never attribute a specific weather event to climate change directly. There are other factors always. But these downpours in Germany behind this flooding, we're hearing that the rainfall has been called unimaginable volumes of rain. More than 18 gallons of water could pour down on an area within just a few hours. You know, when you hear this kind of number, that kind of water coming down, is that something that you, who studies these, you know, severe weather, did that click like, oh yeah, that's what we're going to be seeing?
It's one of the very well-known aspects of climate change that we see more extreme rainfall and also more extreme rainfall coming down in a shorter time. And we know from tropical countries, which are hotter, that there is a lot more rain coming down in a short amount of time. And when we have higher temperatures in more mid-latitudes, we also see this kind of rainfall. So it's not, in that sense, it's not a surprise.
Yeah. No, although it was shocking to the people in Germany, people charged with alerting people, the water rose so fast, you know, some people couldn't get response out in time. They were caught off guard. I mean, it's just, we see the pictures. It's just unimaginable. However, you know, people like you have imagined it. So answer the people who say 80% of Bangladesh is a floodplain. It floods there. Amsterdam built a series of flood protections because it floods. The Mississippi River floods. Why is this different?
Well, the main difference is in Bangladesh, everyone gets a flood warning on their phone when there are flood alerts so that people have time to evacuate and people know that floods are dangerous and evacuate. Even in the U.S., you get the TV programs and radio shows are interrupted to warn people for extreme weather events. Nothing like this exists in Germany. Also, people are not educated that weather can be dangerous. So that is, I think, one of the really important aspects of why the death toll was so high. And that, I think, is one of the really important lessons Germany has to learn.
Yeah, well, and maybe other parts of the world watching, because there was flooding in the New York subways a couple weeks ago, sinkholes in Manhattan. One wonders what would have happened if they were sinkholes under high-rise buildings and not out in the street. is part of what you're saying, that places that didn't have this kind of flooding before need to find ways to prepare for it.
Well, absolutely. So even if the role of climate change in these rainfall events was relatively small, it is exactly the kind of extreme event that we are seeing in many parts of the world to become more intense and more frequent. That if there's one thing you prepare for in a warming world, it's heat waves and it's extreme rainfall events. Yeah. And of course, Germany also, and especially that part of Germany, is a very, very industrial and very densely populated area. So a lot of floodplains are completely built up. So when rain like this falls down, it just has nowhere to go. The rivers have nowhere to go. So that is another important, important adaptation measure that has to be implemented to renaturalize some of the floodplains and give the river some space to go, because otherwise it goes where people are and literally drowns them.
Yeah. Are you getting the sense that wealthier countries are learning that their infrastructure isn't going to stand up to the effects of climate change? There might have been a sense of, that happens in Bangladesh, and yes, they prepare for it because they're in a floodplain, but we have, fill in the blank. Is there a sense that richer countries can't hold off the effects of climate change?
That seems definitely to be a feeling this summer. There are adaptation measures that could be implemented, but of course they have to be implemented. I think this hubris that we've seen in Germany particular, that, nothing will happen here, because we are this historically engineering nation, is certainly waning.
Yeah. You mentioned heat. You were part of a 9-day round-the-clock scientific study to determine what role global warming played in triggering that heat dome that hung over the Pacific Northwest last month and just baked it. What did you find there?
So we found the temperatures, these extremely high temperatures, that they would have been basically impossible to reach without man-made climate change. We also found that it's still a very rare event, so approximately a 1-in-1,000-year event in today's climate, so with 1.2 degrees of global warming. But we also looked in how the likelihood of such an event is changing with increasing temperatures. And at 2-degree warming, so only 0.8 degrees warmer than we are now, it would be happening about every 5 to 10 years.
Mm. We have big climate talks coming up in November. What impact do you hope, or maybe even know already, having talked to people, this past summer might have on those talks?
Well, I really, really hope that what this summer has shown is that just how important it is to keep global temperatures from rising above 1.5 degrees, but also that all the measures to transform our economic system to not being one dependent on burning fossil fuels, we have also to put an incredible amount of effort into adaptation and into making our societies more resilient. And that is in particular important for heat waves, because heat waves are by far the deadliest extreme event in the developed world. And I don't think that has really hit home yet to everyone making decisions on housing infrastructure, on education, on climate adaptation locally. And I really hope that we don't need more wake-up calls than this summer has shown us.
Well, we'll just give us an example. What can Seattle and Portland and cities in the northwest of America do to be more preventive when it comes to people dying from the heat?
So there are very simple measures that one can do. Drink a lot of water. And we have seen that in the area there were already cooling centers, so just public buildings that were air conditioned, that were open, so people could go there and cool down. But people, of course, need to know that's what they have to do and that they otherwise might die, and especially those people who are vulnerable, and that's the elderly, those with existing health conditions, and of course also those who live in poor neighborhoods, which often are very poorly insulated and so get extremely hot or have no air conditioning. And then on the slightly more longer term, we need to change how our cities are designed. With all the concrete and basically no green spaces, we have what's called the heat island effect, so that temperatures in the cities get a lot higher than they would otherwise if there were green spaces. And so we need to redesign cities to have more trees, to have more parks, just to keep temperatures lower and prevent people from dying from heat.
That's Friedrich Otto, Associate Director of the Environmental Change Institute at the University of Oxford in the UK. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
With a population of 45 million people, Argentina has become the fifth country in Latin America to surpass 100,000 COVID-19-related deaths. And as the death toll continues to climb, it's become more difficult to contain the spread of the virus. James Granger is a journalist in Buenos Aires and joins us now. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Buenos Aires is experiencing a second wave of COVID-19 right now. James, I wonder, is that visible? I mean, what do you see around you?
Over the last few weeks, what's kind of happened is we've had a consistent death toll of pretty much 500 a day or more. In terms of cases, the last few weeks, we've actually had a little downturn, I would say. The numbers are stabilizing out at around 15,000 to 20,000 a day. But there's a lot of fears here about the Delta variant, which really hasn't arrived here. So we're kind of having a lot of fears about a potential third wave as well.
Nationwide, there have been almost 4.8 million confirmed cases and an average of 14 or more than 15,000 new infections reported every day. Those numbers are pretty high compared to neighboring countries like Chile and Ecuador, where cases are dropping more significantly. Do officials know why this is happening?
Well, I think, I mean, it's very complicated because there are certain sectors of the population, like what we would call in English, I guess, the shanty towns, the kind of biches, where it's harder to control the spread of the virus, for sure. But I think one of the other things that plays into that is vaccination as well. I mean, Argentina's not been vaccinating as quick a rate as countries like Uruguay and Chile. And we've seen that kind of pick up over the last few weeks. I mean, certainly, you know, the spread of the virus inside and in certain areas has been in control. And we had a very large and lengthy lockdown period, which the government's trying to come out of now because we have so many economic challenges as well.
So a couple things you mentioned there, both the lockdown and the vaccination. And let me start with vaccinations first. Where does the vaccination campaign stand at this point?
I think we're going to get to maybe today or tomorrow, we're going to get to kind of 50% of the population with the first dose. But the second dose process, a lot of those have been delayed. And obviously, Argentina had some problems acquiring vaccines. There was certain problems with contracts with the US kind of made vaccines like Pfizer and Moderna. But we've seen the first kind of shots of those come into the country over the last couple of weeks. And I think, you know, in general terms, the vaccination is starting to quicken now.
So you also talked about the lockdown because Argentina was doing quite well at the beginning of the pandemic. There was a very strict lockdown. Those restrictions were lifted. They were eased for the summer. Do people connect the easing of those restrictions with these surges in cases?
I think you have to accept that that's part of the thing. But Argentina has been in recession for 3 years. And the lockdown last year led to an economic decline in 2020 of 9.9%. I mean, we're expecting to bounce back this year, but, you know, the poverty rate has risen, the unemployment rate has risen. And I mean, these things are, you know, they're really challenging for the population and the government, which has had to spend billions and billions of pesos in support programs for kind of the poorest segments of society, but also for companies as well. The government was paying 50% of private sector wages up to a certain point to kind of sustain jobs.
Well, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what's going on with the economy, because earlier this year here, we heard the vice president say that Argentina will not be able to repay its debt to the International Monetary Fund, a loan of $45 billion, because it doesn't have the money. We're seeing in a country where the inflation rate is always high, inflation rates being alarmingly Hi. What can
try earning in pesos? You know,
yeah,
difficult.
Right. So what's being done? What can be done?
In terms of inflation, it's very difficult. I mean, as of last month, for the last 12 months, the inflation rate is now 50.2%. And in terms of the IMF, I mean, obviously, our vice president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, who was our former president, the segment of her political support doesn't obviously want to pay off that loan. But, I mean, talks are actually ongoing. And Argentina is obviously trying to talk to the Biden administration as well to get its support for the IMF, you know, eventually when any deal goes to a vote. So I don't know if that will be sealed before our midterm elections, but definitely the government side and the IMF officials have made very good noises, and they had some very good meetings at the G20 summit in Venice. So, you know, there is a possibility there of restructuring the debt, but the economy is in a very difficult situation, and Argentina really needs to get back on its feet because, you know, I mean, as I say, poverty is up, unemployment is up, and, you know, the people are suffering.
And I wondered, I mean, honestly, morale can't be made easier by the fact that the Copa America soccer tournament is right now being played in Brazil and not in Argentina. You know, how would you describe sort of the mood of most people just as you move through the day in Buenos Aires?
Well, I mean, the Copa America just finished and Argentina won, so everyone's quite happy regarding that, especially to win it in Brazil.
Even if it didn't happen moment. In their own nation, yeah.
No, I mean, look, let's be honest. I mean, Lionel Messi lifting the trophy in Brazil's home turf is even better, I think, maybe for them. But, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult, but the Argentine population has a real ability to improvise and to resist. There's always a sense of optimism in the air because the people are that way, you know?
James Granger is a journalist in Buenos Aires. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.